This is WMPG. My name is Dr. Anne, and this is Safe Space Radio for Courageous Conversations. This interview is the fourth in our series on child abuse. The first two interviews focused on the long-term impact of child abuse on physical and emotional health. Last week, in the third interview, we heard from Bree Maselli about the emotional abuse of children growing up in a home with domestic violence. Today, I'll be speaking with Carl Russell about childhood sexual abuse by a priest. The Reverend Carl Russell is an Episcopal priest, originally from Portland, who was ordained in 1961 and has served parishes in Connecticut and Massachusetts, as well as Wynn, Maine, and then Millinocket and Portland, Maine. He and his wife, who is also a retired Episcopal priest, have four children, seven grandchildren, and live in Booth Bay Harbor, Maine. Welcome to Safe Space, Carl.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ann.
I'd like to start by having you kind of put the story in context, because sexual abuse by a priest, I think, is particularly influenced by how much spiritual authority and power the person has by virtue of their office. And I'd love to have you tell me a little bit about the role that this man played in your family as a child before the abuse even started, that sort of set the stage for everything that followed.
Well, that's the thing. The stage was being set when I was about seven. My parents had been Congregationalists, and they had discovered the Episcopal Church because of my brother, who went to this church because of the scout troop. And my mother's mother was dying, my Nana, and my brother invited this priest to come into our home while we were still Congregationalists, but to pray with my grandmother. It was a very impressive moment. We had never known anything liturgical. We had never known anything about the prayers that were prescribed in the Book of Common Prayer. And so when he came and he had those things to use, it made a huge impact on us. He anointed her with oil. He laid his hands on her. And I watched this, and I thought, this is amazing. And
this is holy.
Very holy. And he had, you know, purple stole on to do the anointing. But it was not just that. I was very impressed by that myself at age seven. In fact, it's one of the reasons why I decided I wanted to be a priest. I really wanted to be like him at that point. And then I watched what my mother and father did in response to this. And they were blown away by this man. And then when my Nana died, my mother went into a depression. And he came and was very, very effective, basically for all of us, because we'd sort of lost my mother in the process. I mean, she was so exhausted and so depressed that she was like a different person. I talk in the book about she was like the architect of our home, but we lost her. And he really was effective in bringing her back into herself. So he began to play a very important role in our family.
So he was like a hero.
Oh, he was a hero indeed. And he started coming to the house on a regular basis. He ate at least one meal a week with us. He spent time in the living room with us. I watched my mother and father defer to him. There's one incident in the book where my mother was making hamburger on a Friday, and my father came home and had just gotten into this whole Catholic piece of can't have meat on Friday. So I heard my father telling my mother, we can't feed the family this hamburger. And he went to the telephone in front of me and called this priest to ask his permission to feed his family. You know, the effect of me was unbelievable.
Right, so he had enormous authority. Your father would defer to him versus his wife on what you could eat for supper, even though that supper was already cooked.
Absolutely. And so the picture I got was that this man was like a god in our family. He was. And so when I think this is how it all began, and I was only seven. I think he already had targeted me, but he was very careful, very slow. It was probably another year before anything happened. The first thing I talk about, it began with a kiss. And it began with a kiss when I was very sick They called him to do what he had done for my grandmother. They trusted him implicitly. So he came upstairs. I was in my bedroom alone. And he prayed with me. But then he bent over and kissed me, and he kissed me on the lips. That was the first kind of unusual feeling that I had. But I did not feel then or any time until I was 50 years old that I could ever tell anybody even that. But then it got much more elaborate, much more involved as I, and this took, went on for 6 years, you know.
So they call this grooming, you know, in the field.
Yes.
where somebody who abuses children gradually establishes trust, establishes a so-called special relationship.
Yep.
So when does it feel to you in some ways that it moved from that kind of cultivating that specialness toward actual abuse?
Well, there's one thing I would add to this, and that is that I think he not only groomed me, but more importantly, he groomed my family.
Yes.
He groomed my mother and father, and he had them in a place of complete confidence. And that, plus he had also made moves on at least one of my brothers, whose testimony is in the book. He didn't do much with my brother, nothing like he did with me. But he knew that my brother didn't tell. So I think he knew he was safe. And then I was appointed an acolyte, and that's when the more difficult stuff began.
And partly because being an acolyte meant you would meet him alone early in the morning before the service.
That's right.
The two of you would be getting on your your vestments in a very private space.
Very private.
You also, in the book, you write about instances where he would call your home and ask you to come over alone to help him with certain errands.
Yes. One of the times was he called and said to my father that he needed help to put out the diocesan magazine that he was the editor of, and could I come over and help him? And I told my father I didn't want to go. But my father said, oh, yeah, we help out. You know, he was so compliant. And so he took me over and dropped me off.
I found that part of the book almost unbearable to read, because here you are trying to say to your father, no, mm-hmm. I don't want to go. Mm-hmm. Your father basically makes you go, mm-hmm. puts you in the car, drives you, and deposits you, completely trusting, mm-hmm. into this man's home. And you describe him meeting you there in his silk bathrobe at the door.
And that's why I've never been able to see that. That's what I mean by this underlying thing that governs you. Because my wife gave me a silk bathrobe once for Christmas, and I reamed her out about spending so much money on this in front of my children. And I put it aside and said, I don't like bathrobes anyway. I had no idea why I was doing that. And I never used it.
I think as a parent, I found that story particularly chilling, because I think about times that, you know, your child protests having to do lots of things in life, right? Go to practices or do homework. And as a parent, you make them do certain things. And I just thought, almost with a growing sense of horror, I listened to that story about your father delivering you in some ways to the first incidents that was really explicitly sexual.
I mean, this took place over a very long period of time. He was very patient, and the move was made very gradually, and it got more and more explicit. And I didn't think that I could tell anybody about this. He kept telling me that it was a good thing, that we were doing what men and boys do. The only time I ever asked him am I being good or not? Because I used to ask my mother all the time, was I a good boy or a bad boy when I was my 5 or 6 years old? That mattered to me. And I had the feeling, and I think this is the struggle for people who have been sexually abused, I had the feeling that way down deep that this wasn't a good thing. But he kept telling me that it was a good thing, and that I was special, and how much he loved me. And so I felt very loved.
So, and part of what I'm hearing that this all unfolded in the context where you weren't able to talk about it at all. So here you were having this moral dilemma inside yourself. Is this good or is this bad? Some internal part of you was registering, this doesn't feel quite right. But the authority figure that you're with, who's sort of invested in with the power of a god, practically, is telling you repeatedly how good it is, how right it is. Yep. And your family, I mean, did you get a puberty talk? Was your family talking about sexuality at that point?
Not really, no.
So this occurs in sort of the vacuum of silence.
That's right, exactly. And the silence is protected by shame, pretty much. I mean, I don't know at that age if I knew what shame was, but I knew this was secret, and he kept saying, no one must ever know what we do here. So that was like a mantra. And if you ever tell anybody something bad's going to happen to you.
Did he say that? He threatened you?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, no one will understand. This is special, you know. So, I to this day look back and think, how did this go on for 6 years? You know, what was wrong with me, you know? At one point, I began to think that I was the one doing the seducing. I mean, that there was something about me that was making him do this.
Yes.
And it's very subtle. You know, it's not the kind of thing that's at the front of your frontal lobe. It's sort of down deep somewhere. And I know that he manipulated that and that he took advantage of that, you know.
I think every survivor of sexual abuse that I have ever spoken with has felt that at some way. How was it my fault?
Yeah.
It must have been something about me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is such an insidious part of the legacy,
right,
of it.
And his fetish was phallic. It was a phallic fetish. And so I began to think that that part of me was bad. And I wanted to not have that. I wanted that to go away. It's so complex, you know, and there's nobody to talk to. And so I think a child, at least I as a child, drew all kinds of wrong conclusions. You know, I didn't have the equipment emotionally or mentally to make good sense out of this. I made bad sense out of it. I made sense out of it, but I didn't make good sense.
Well, and to just be fair for a moment, it doesn't make any sense what he was doing to you.
No.
And yet, of course, you tried to make meaning of it, because we all do.
That's right.
But it's so poignant, because there you were, 12 years old, you know, entering puberty, and learning to hate part of your own body.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The hard way to proceed. And the power of this, I was struck reading your book, that even in your marriage, that it took listening to a story on the radio.
Yeah.
And so tell me that story, if you would, about how you really decided to break this silence.
Well, it kind of broke itself. I in the book, I refer to it as an eruption, because it came completely out of the blue. I was preparing supper, and I was peeling potatoes, looking down in the field at our son's horse. I guess it was WBUR that I was listening to down there, and they did a section on the breaking news of the Archdiocese of Boston and the sexual abuse of children. And the most interesting thing is, there were no children being interviewed, but I began to hear a child weeping. And I kind of got focused on this weeping child, and then I realized that I was weeping, that I was weeping. I lost track of the program, and this weeping child began to get my attention. And then I was sobbing. I was leaning on the sink, looking out at the horse, and I lost track of everything. And then I heard my wife come in, and my son was in the other room welcoming her. And then she came over and kissed me on the neck and said, what's happening? And I couldn't talk. And so she took me into the living room. We sat down in the living room, and that's the point. I told her there's much more about me that you don't know. And not everything didn't come back at once. It was just that I was aware again of what I had been stuffing and that there was a lot more to it. I couldn't have told her then what it was, but I did tell her that. And she put her arms around me and said, go ahead and cry. We'll get through this. We'll get through this. And that's when I started for the first time to say, but you don't know what I have to tell you. And when I did that, I was looking at her and thinking, this could ruin our relationship. But she had given me enough encouragement, so I thought I'm safe. So I began to tell her, and then little by little, this began to come up. But it took years before I was able to really begin to identify particulars. I had pretty much stuffed most of what I knew about this.
I think one of the things that people often don't understand about childhood sexual abuse is that, in fact, it does take years to get clear about it and to be able to speak about it.
And not only that, but a lot of those years, in my case, I wasn't even aware of it. I had put it on a shelf somewhere. It wasn't until that began to come up, and I think I was 46 years old or something like that. And then I didn't deal with it for years.
Right. So, and I think this in many ways can be the norm, you know, and I think sometimes people feel very suspicious about stories that come out so many decades later.
Yeah.
But I think it makes sense when something happens to you and you're so young and it's so hard to make sense of, and there's so much threat around telling it.
Absolutely.
And so much shame.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that the Maine waived the statute of limitations on this is really important, because it can take a long time.
So when you say that, what do you mean? What has Maine done? I don't know.
Well, I believe I'm correct. Maine, in other words, there's no statute of limitations on bringing a charge against somebody if you finally realize what's happened. And I did that. I sued my abuser.
So let's talk about that. When did you do that, and what made you decide to sue him?
I did that when I was 72 years old, and he was 95. And it was my brother who convinced me, you have got to say no if you're ever going to get healthy. You've got to, he said. I said, I'm too afraid to do that. You know, I had a lot of fear even at that age. And he said, well, I think the only way you're ever going to deal with this is you're going to have to go to court. So
that's what he meant by saying no.
Yeah. And so I called a personal injury lawyer who helped me to frame my no, and we sued. And I did get a settlement. There's another whole story that goes with that, because the settlement caused me all kinds of problems. I had struggle with the feeling that was somehow some sort of prostitution, that there had been a price put.
That you got money for what had happened to you.
Yeah. It was a mix. I felt some guilt about that. And not, in other words, that I was somehow prostituting myself by doing that. But on the other hand, it also gave a worth to the childhood, I think, I lost. So, I mean, it was important to put a worth on that. But I've had this, still have that. There's a lot of stuff that's not finished. You know, there really is.
So what you're saying is, on the one hand, the settlement was very validating. It was an acknowledgement that what happened was wrong.
Yeah.
And that you lost something inexplicably precious.
Very much so.
And on the other hand, it felt like receiving money for sexual acts. And it was how I met, and what you write about a little bit is you felt unable to spend it on yourself as a result.
No, I never spent a penny of it on myself.
It's such complicated money.
Yeah, it is.
And the truth is, you can't put a value on the childhood that you lost.
No, you can't. There's no way to put
it's
a value
priceless.
On that. And what's stolen is, You know, the interesting thing is I called the book No Telling Aloud, Keeping Secrets That Hurt, because in some respects, the greater damage done to me was not telling, was keeping the secret. That his insistence that this could never be told, and that's one reason why the suit was so helpful to me, because I told in legal terms what happened and charged him with it. And the book is the other half of it. The other half is, and even broadcasting like this, you know, is the first time that I've actually told aloud. You can't beat broadcasting for that. I mean, that's about as told as you can get it. So anyway, that's...
I feel so honored to be part of that with you.
Thank you so much.
Mm. So when you say, if anything, the greatest damage was in the not telling, what is the damage you're talking about? What do you mean?
Well, I kept the secret. I didn't get the therapy I should have gotten years and years and years and years ago. As a result, it affected my professional life, the way I dealt with people, the way I... it affected my marriage. I kept this... I basically lied to my wife for 40 years of our marriage. And it's down deep, but it does still operate. And so it has affected the way I think about men. I have a real hard time. I've never joined a men's group. I have no male friends. I mean, those things, there are consequences to letting that secret lie there and do me damage from the inside out. You know, the abuse was outside in, but when it gets in there, then it begins to run things. It begins to govern some of your behavior. And the more I am uncovering, the more I'm seeing the consequences of this.
You also talk about the confusion of your own body responding to him, and how difficult it was to tease out your own sense of responsibility when there was some pleasure for you.
Absolutely. And that's the hardest thing of all. And it was the last thing I was able to write about. I had the worst time bringing myself to talk about the fact that I enjoyed this. You know, and so what I had to do was to try to think through, well, okay, it's actually good that my body enjoyed this. That's the way my body was made. And so we're supposed to do that. But that's what sexual abuse does. It creates this incredible confusion where you want to deny the body by saying, well, no, this didn't feel good. But that's not healthy.
Say that's not healthy, what do you mean?
Well, I think because your body is a good thing. I mean, your body is just a part of yourself. And we are made to enjoy this stuff. And it's a good thing. But in denying it, by denying that I enjoyed it, then I was beginning to deny a whole big piece of myself. And so the way I have dealt with it is to tell about it. That's about the only way at this point that I know how to deal with it. So I decided I need to talk about it, and I need to thank my body for being faithful and doing what it was supposed to do, even though it was in the middle of an inappropriate and traumatic moment. But the shame is still a struggle.
Yeah. And so when you say that, what do you still feel shame for with this?
I can't really put a finger on it. The shame persists. I haven't been able to shake it altogether. I've intellectualized it. I've done all those things. I think partly because in this culture, sexual activity... I grew up in a very puritanical background. And so sexual activity was pretty much, you know, on the top of the list of shameful behavior. So...
Right, so talking about sex at all is already shameful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And fortunately, I had a wonderful wife. At age 14, I stopped all of this with him. At age 15, I met my wife in high school. And she was very, very beautiful, and she was very responsive to me, and I began to experience lust on my own part. See, I was the object of his lust, but he was never the object of my love, my love or my lust. My body was responding, but my body wasn't giving anything. And when I finally met my wife and I began to experience lust, and I was excited by her body and excited by her beauty, then I think things began to click into place a lot. But
what do you mean, click into place?
Well, I began to realize that this is what it's supposed to be about. You know, I'm supposed to choose who I want to be with, and I'm supposed to give something to that person. And I'm supposed to, I mean, it became reciprocal. There had never been anything reciprocal. And as I said in that little piece about the sexual enjoyment, I think sometimes the word abuse can be very helpful to us because it makes us feel like an object and we can complain about it and so forth. But, you know, there's more to it than that. I was abused, but using the word abuse tends to make us objects, and I don't think that's healthy.
What word would you choose instead?
Exploited.
How is that less of an object?
Because I think that by being exploited, we are drawn into something. We become. I don't want to have been an object. I want to have been a living, breathing human who had feelings and
all the way through.
I think I was the object of his abuse. I understand that, but I was a lot more than that, and that's what he tried to destroy. You know. So.
Thank you, Carl, for being my guest.
Thank you for letting me tell my story.
This is Dr. Ann. I've been speaking with Carl Russell about his experience as a boy being exploited by his own childhood priest. I want to tell you that Carl's book is called No Telling Allowed, and that's A-L-O-U-D. No Telling Allowed, Keeping Secrets That Hurt. And the book is coming out in June, I understand.
I hope.
And will be available through Amazon and even more importantly in your local bookstore. I want to thank today Gabe Graben for being the producer for this show, Jen Hodson for mixing the sound, Maurice Lennon for the music, Jim Russell for my consultant. If you did not get a chance to listen to all of this interview, and if you would like to, please go to our website at www.safespaceradio.com. You can email me there at drann@safespaceradio.com if you have a request or a suggestion for a future topic. You can also email subscribe if you'd like to get a weekly email with a link to that week's show. You can also download us from iTunes and like us on Facebook. Coming up next is Speak Freely.